You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard Lopate today. Imagine what would happen if, when you were in middle school, suddenly the world's rotation began to slow. Days and nights grew longer, gravity became stronger, and all of the activity on Earth was suddenly disturbed. Karen Thompson Walker's first novel, The Age of Miracles, dances the fine line between magical realism and science fiction. Her book is published by Random House, and I'm pleased to have Karen Thompson Walker with us today. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Karen, your protagonist is a young girl named Julia, who is 11 years old. She's just on the cusp of being a teenager. Why did you choose to have this book, to tell this book through her story?
You know, I've always been interested in that time of life. I think adolescence is a really just a fascinating time, you know, that time when you still are a child and yet you're beginning to notice some things about the adult world. So I've always been interested. And then as I sat down to try to tell this story, you know, that is really a story of a global catastrophe, focusing on a young girl felt like a way that I could tell this big story in a way that would feel really personal and intimate and real.
So did the global catastrophe idea come first and then Julia came next?
Yeah, the idea came first, and it came from a newspaper article I read, which was back in 2004. I read that the earthquake that caused the tsunami that year in Indonesia was so powerful that it also affected the rotation of the Earth. So our 24-hour days were shortened by, you know, a fraction of a second per day. And I was really haunted by that. And I immediately started to wonder what would happen if a much larger shift were to take place. So that was the kernel. But as soon as I wrote the first few sentences, the voice that seemed right was that of a woman looking back on childhood. So that was sort of the beginning of Julia's character.
Well, that's a wonderful introduction. Could you read a little bit from your book?
Sure. So this is the opening. We didn't notice right away. We couldn't feel it. We did not sense at first the extra time bulging from the smooth edge of each day like a tumor blooming beneath skin. We were distracted back then by weather and war. We had no interest in the turning of the earth. Bombs continued to explode on the streets of distant countries. Hurricanes came and went. Summer ended. A new school year began. The clocks ticked as usual. Seconds beaded into minutes. Minutes grew into hours, and there was nothing to suggest that those hours, too, were not still pooling into days, each the same fixed length known to every human being. But there were those who would later claim to have recognized the disaster before the rest of us did. These were the night workers, the graveyard shifters, the stockers of shelves and the loaders of ships, the drivers of big rig trucks, or else they were the bearers of different burdens, the sleepless and the troubled and the sick. These people were accustomed to waiting out the night. Through bloodshot eyes, a few did detect a certain persistence of darkness on the mornings leading up to the news, but each mistook it for the private misperception of a lonely, rattled mind. On the 6th of October, the experts went public. This, of course, is the day we all remember. There'd been a change, they said, a slowing, and that's what we called it from then on, the slowing. We have no way of knowing if this trend will continue, said a shy, bearded scientist at a hastily arranged press conference, now infamous. He cleared his throat and swallowed. Cameras flashed in his eyes. Then came the moment, replayed so often afterward, that the particular cadences of that scientist's speech, the dips and the pauses, and that slight Midwestern slant, would be forever married to the news itself. He went on, but we suspect that it will continue. Our days had grown by 56 minutes in the night.
This is the way the book begins. And you talk about Julia and talk about middle school. And Julia is a particularly observant child. She really is paying attention both to the turmoil of middle school and then also to what's happening in the world around her.
That's right. Yeah, I wanted her to be that way. She's a little bit shy. She's a little bit on the periphery of
her. She's standing outside often.
Yes, exactly. So I think that makes her a good narrator, and maybe it also makes life at that age difficult for her, though. You know, she feels always a little unhappily apart from the crowd and from the group. And she's an only child. I think that's part of why she's such a good observer, because she's used to being, outnumbered by adults and being part of her family, but different than the other two members, since she's the only child. And that little kernel comes from my own experience, because I was an only child.
And another piece that may come from your own experience is this happens in California, where disasters are sort of always in the back of everybody's mind.
That's right. You know, what's interesting is they are and they aren't. I think that when you live in California, you can be easily reminded that a huge disaster is possible. You know, your life could change in an instant because of, you know, an earthquake or a brush fire. But most of the time, you don't think about it. And that's something I've thought about a lot related to my book, because I think, I mean, intentionally and sometimes unconsciously, I think I was learning from my experience growing up in California how to predict how people in the book would react to this huge catastrophe, but it's one that unfolds somewhat gradually, so it allows for a certain amount of ordinary life to go on even in the face of this huge uncertainty.
As the book goes on, this slowing gets slower and slower, and people divide into two groups. The groups who are on clock time, there's an edict that we will have our 24 hours regardless of whether the sun is in the sky or not, and people who decide to go completely against that. What led you to think about this sort of pulling apart of society when this happened?
Well, I wrote this book in chronological order, so I felt as I was writing the book, you know, chapter by chapter, I was sort of figuring out or finding out using my own imagination and a little research what would happen not only to the planet but also to society. You know, I was arriving at questions as I wrote and then trying to figure out what the answer was. And so one of those questions would be what would we do about the clocks? So because as soon as the rotation of the Earth slows down, then the 24-hour clock no longer corresponds to a length of a natural day on Earth. And it just seemed... It seemed likely and realistic to me, which was important to make it realistic, that the government would say, you know, just to stave off chaos, that we have to stick to the 24-hour clock. And, you know, public schools and businesses adhere to that, and most people do. But I knew as soon as I made that decision that there would be some people who would rebel against that, who would want to do something more natural, more, you might say, organic, you know, and they would want to live their lives according to the rising and the setting of the sun, even though that is increasingly unpredictable. So then the days are getting, you know, 30 hours, 40 hours. And then once I had the two groups, it just felt logical that they would not easily get along, because now not only do they not understand each other's positions, they literally live on different time scales. So they're kind of literally out of sync.
And you even explore what this would happen to people who might have religious beliefs that require sundowns and sunrises.
That's right. Yeah, I was very interested in, I mean, it doesn't play a huge part in the book, but I was very interested in thinking about and capturing the different ways that religious people would respond to this. So just for example, there's an Orthodox Jewish family who lives down the street from Julia, and in order to observe the Sabbath as they feel is the right way, I mean accurately, they don't feel they can live on the 24-hour clock because it no longer corresponds to sunrise and sundown. I mean, yeah.
As you wrote this, I was thinking of you writing this when I was reading it, because you wrote it in the mornings before you went off to your job as an editor.
Right.
Did you begin to feel like you were not living on clock time, that your days were different from other people's?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I wrote in the mornings because that was, well, one, my mind is just clearest. It's still the best time for me to write. But when I was writing the book, I had a very demanding schedule because of my job. And so the morning, just an hour before, was the only time I could figure out to write. And it did feel, I don't know if I felt like I was living on a different type of time, but I did feel like I was kind of stealing an hour that other people, you know, that I wouldn't have had if I didn't. I was stealing an hour of my own sleep also, but kind of before, you know, before the work emails started to rush in, I could sit at my desk at home and write for an hour on my own project.
What was it like for you, having been an editor for a while, editing and writing are so closely linked, but they're really different roles.
That's right. You know, for me, I think just naturally the way that I write includes a lot of editing. You know, it's almost as if I'm writing and editing at the same time. So in a way, there was probably, for me, a natural connection between being an editor and a writer, because I write a sentence and then I rearrange it three times and then I move on to the next sentence, and that part feels like editing. But it's still a little strange in a great way to be on this other side, to be the author now and not only the editor.
In the book, it's interesting to hear you say, as you got to various points, you would think, what would happen now? And there's a lot of what will happen now. Birds start suffering like the proverbial canary in the coal mine. Birds show the effects of this first, and then the magnetic poles start shifting. Did you have to do a lot of research to think, all right, what might happen if the Earth's rotation slowed down?
I did do research, and I did it, you know, along the way, like as you said, as I arrived at some new situation, then I would do more research. You know, and some of the research I did actually was a little accidental, you know, just came from reading the paper every day. So every time in the science section, if there was some detail related that might relate to my book, say something about sleep disorders or how people live who live above the Arctic Circle, which is the closest parallel I could think of to what the people in my book are experiencing. And then certainly the physics, I really had to do a fair amount of research to understand how, you know, what the physical effects on the planet. And then in the end, when I had a full draft, I showed it to an astrophysicist.
Well, that must have been a little nerve-wracking.
It was very nerve-wracking. And the reason I didn't show it to him or to someone earlier is because it just felt a little presumptuous to bother a real scientist doing, you know, important scientific work with something I was just making up on my laptop that I had no idea if it would ever go anywhere. So I waited till the end, and actually till after I had sold it. But he was a really wonderful reader. And in general, I was relieved by how much of the physics he felt was, you know, how much of it was based in real science. And then he also helped me correct a few things. So he was crucial.
When you began this book, had you already been someone who was really interested in these kind of alternative realities, the sort of science fiction of playing with what we have now, but twisting it just slightly so suddenly everything is different?
You know, I've always loved science in a kind of maybe amateurish way is the right word, because I love to read about science, but I never planned to be a scientist. But I love to read science about science that is sort of has an element of wonder, you know. So anything to do with space or time is always really fascinating to me. So that I definitely have always been interested in. And then it's true that some of my favorite, you know, books and movies do have some sort of interesting premise that you might call science fiction, like The Road by Cormac McCarthy, or Blindness by Jose Saramago. And my favorite ones are always the ones that if they do have some sort of alternate reality, but then the focus is really on the people and how the people would react in a nuanced and realistic way given a strange situation.
Which sounds very much like what you said at the very beginning, which is this idea came to you, but you had to find Julia in order to really tell the story.
That's right. Yeah, because the characters are, I don't want to say more important, but just every bit as important as this kind of fun, strange scenario that I was writing.
Fun.
Well, it was fun to write.
Exactly. Probably not fun for the people who lived through it, but fun. I can see the fun to write. This is your first novel, and it's getting a lot of attention. What is that like as a first-time novelist to find your book everywhere?
Strange, but wonderful. You know, I mean, my background in publishing, being an editor, really prepared me for the exact opposite experience, because I just know how hard it is to publish a novel at all, especially a first novel. And one of the hard things about working in book publishing was watching books that had a lot of great elements or were really beautifully written not get picked up by a publisher or else not get reviewed. So I was expecting the opposite I was worried about the opposite happening when I sent it to my agent. But it's been a wonderful surprise, and it's a little bit like an out-of-body experience. It's a little hard to believe, but I feel very lucky.
Do you have a sense of why it's resonating so powerfully? I mean, I know some people have sort of looked at it as an allegory for what we may be doing to our environment in other ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me as the author to say, you know, exactly what people are responding to. But it has been interesting to hear people draw a connection to our real world. And certainly, you know, I wanted to write this book as just a realistic and moving story. So that's where my attention was as I wrote it, rather than trying to convey a particular message. But it has been interesting to see people draw parallels to just what's facing our environment. And I certainly did use, you know, say, the debates about climate change and the effects of climate change as a parallel situation that I tried to learn from as I tried to predict how this one would unfold.
You mentioned that this is a woman looking back at this very powerful moment in her life. Does Julia live on for you? Do you find yourself even now being able to hold the book in your hands that you think, oh, Julia might be doing this now?
I mean, when I finished editing it, I was very glad to be done with it because I'd sort of lived with it, lived that way with the book and with Julia, I guess you could say, for, you know, years. But I've noticed the more time that goes by from when I've stopped working on the book, the more I feel, you know, a little curious, like what's she doing now or what would she be doing now? I don't know that I'll ever write another book with her, but, you know, who knows?
Well, thank you so much for coming in to talk about your new book with us today. I've been speaking with Karen Thompson Walker about her book, The Age of Miracles. It's published by Random House. Thanks so much.
Thank you.